There may be, and altogether too often there is, developed out of the meeting of two or more minds a negative power, which is just the opposite to a mastermind. There are certain minds which, as has already been stated throughout this lesson, cannot be made to blend in the spirit of harmony. This principle has its comparable analogy in chemistry, reference to which may enable the student to grasp more clearly the principle here referred to. For example, the chemical formula H2O, meaning the combining of two atoms of hydrogen with one atom of oxygen, changes these two elements into water. One atom of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen will not produce water. Moreover, they cannot be made to associate themselves in harmony. There are many known elements which, when combined, are immediately transformed from harmless into deadly, poisonous substances. Stated differently, many will know poisonous elements are neutralized and rendered harmless when combined with certain other elements. Just as the combining of certain elements changes their entire nature, the combining of certain minds changes the nature of those minds, producing either a certain degree of what has been called a mastermind, or its opposite, which is highly destructive. Any man who has found his mother-in-law to be incompatible has experienced the negative application of the principle known as a mastermind. For some reason, as yet unknown to investigators in the field of mind behavior, the majority of mother-in-law appear to affect their daughter husbands in a highly negative manner, the meeting of their minds with those of their son-in-laws creating a highly antagonistic influence instead of a mastermind. This fact is too well known as a truth to make extended comment necessary. Some minds will not be harmonized and cannot be blended into a mastermind, a fact which all leaders of men will do well to remember. It is the leader's responsibility so to group his men that those who have been placed at the most strategic points in his organization are made up of individuals whose minds can and will be blended in a spirit of friendliness and harmony. Ability so to group men is the chief outstanding quality of leadership. In Lesson 2 of this course, the student will discover that his ability was the main source of both the power and fortune accumulated by the late Andrew Carnegie. Knowing nothing whatsoever of the technical end of the steel business, Carnegie so combined and grouped the men of which his mastermind was composed that he built the most successful steel industry known to the world during his lifetime. Henry Ford's gigantic success may be traced to the successful application of this self-same principle. With all the self-reliance a man could have, Ford nevertheless did not depend upon himself for the knowledge necessary in the successful development of his industry. Like Carnegie, he surrounded himself with men who supplied the knowledge which he himself did not and could not possess. Moreover, Ford picked men who could and did harmonize in group effort. The most effective alliances which have resulted in the creation of the principle known as the mastermind have been those developed out of the blending of the minds of men and women. The reason for this is the fact that the minds of male and female will more readily blend in harmony than will the minds of males. Also, the added stimulus of sexual contact often enters into the development of a mastermind between a man and a woman. It is a well-known fact that the male of the species is keener and more alert for the chase, let the goal or object of the chase be what it may, when inspired and urged on by a female. This human trait begins to manifest itself in the male at the age of puberty and continues throughout his life. The first evidence may be observed in athletes, where boys are playing before an audience made up of females. Remove the woman from the audience and the game known as football would soon become a very tame affair. A boy will throw himself into a football game with almost superhuman effort when he knows that a girl of his choice is observing him from the grandstand. And that same boy will throw himself into the game of accumulating money with the same enthusiasm when inspired and urged on by a woman of his choice, especially if that woman knows how to stimulate his mind with her own through the law of the mastermind. On the other hand, that same woman may, through a negative application of the law of mastermind, nagging, jealousy, selfishness, greed, and vanity, drag this man down to sure defeat. The late Elbert Hubbard understood the principle here described so well that when he discovered that the incompatibility between himself and his first wife was dragging him down to sure defeat, he ran the gamut of public opinion by divorcing her and marrying the woman who was said to have been the main source of his inspiration. Not every man would have had the courage to defy public opinion as Hubbard did, but who is wise enough to say that his action was not for the best interest of all concerned? A man's chief business in life is to succeed. The road to success may be, and generally is, obstructed by many influences which must be removed before the goal can be reached. One of the most detrimental of these obstacles is that of unfortunate alliance with minds which do not harmonize. In such cases, the alliance must be broken or the end is sure to be defeat and failure. The man who has mastered the six basic fears, one of which is the fear of criticism, will have no hesitancy in taking what may seem to be a more convention-based type of mind to be drastic action when he finds himself circumscribed and bound down by antagonistic alliances, no matter of what nature or with whom they may be. It is a million times better to meet and face criticism than to be dragged down to failure and oblivion on account of alliances which are not harmonious, whether the alliance be of a business or social nature. To be perfectly frank, the author is here justifying divorce, when the conditions surrounding marriage are such that harmony cannot prevail. This is not intended to convey the belief that lack of harmony may not be removed through other methods than that of divorce, for there are instances where the cause of antagonism may be removed and harmony established without taking the extreme step of divorce. While it is true that some minds will not blend in a spirit of harmony and cannot be forced or induced to do so because of the very chemical nature of the individual's brain, do not be too ready to charge the other party to your alliance with all the responsibility of lack of harmony. Remember, the trouble may be with your own brain. Remember also that a mind which cannot and will not harmonize with one person or persons may harmonize perfectly with other types of minds. Discovery of this truth has resulted in radical changes in methods of employing men. It is no longer customary to discharge a man because he does not fit in the position for which he was originally hired. The discriminating leader endeavors to place such a man in some other position where it has been proved more than once misfits may become valuable men. The student of this course should be sure that the principle described as the mastermind is thoroughly understood before proceeding with the remaining lessons of this course. The reason for this is the fact that practically the entire course is closely associated with this law of mind operation. If you are not sure that you understand this law, communicate with the author of the course and secure further explanation by asking such questions as you may wish concerning points in connection with which you believe you cannot need further information. You cannot spend too much time in serious thought and contemplation in connection with the law of the mastermind, for the reason that when you have mastered this law and have learned how to apply in new worlds of opportunity will open for you. This introductory lesson, while not really intended as a separate lesson of the Law of Success course, contains sufficient data to enable the student who has an aptitude for selling to become a master salesman. Any sales organization may make effective use of the law of the mastermind by grouping the salesmen in groups of two or more people who will allay themselves in a spirit of friendly cooperation and apply this law as suggested in this lesson. An agent for a well-known make of automobile who employs 12 salesmen has grouped his organization in six groups of two men each with the object of applying the law of the mastermind, with the results that all salesmen have established new high sales records. This same organization has created what it calls the one-a-week club, meaning that each man belonging to the club has averaged the sale of one car a week since the club was organized. The results of this effort have been surprising to all. Each man belonging to the club was provided with a list of 100 prospective purchasers of automobiles. Each salesman sends one postal card a week to each of his 100 prospective purchasers and makes personal calls on at least 10 of these each day. Each postal card is confined to the description of but one advantage of the automobile a salesman is selling and asks for a personal interview. Interviews have increased rapidly, as have also sales. The agent who employs these salesmen has offered an extra cash bonus to each salesman who earns the right to membership in the one-a-week club by averaging one car a week. The plan has injected new vitality into the entire organization. Moreover, the results of the plan are showing in the weekly sales record of each salesman. A similar plan could be adopted very effectively by life insurance agencies. Any enterprising general agent might easily double or even triple the volume of his business with the same number of salesmen through the use of this plan. Practically no changes whatsoever would need to be made in the method of use of the plan. The club might be called the Policy of a Week Club, meaning that each member pledged himself to sell at least one policy of an agreed minimum amount each week. The student of this course who has mastered the second lesson and understands how to apply the fundamentals of that lesson, a definite chief aim, will be able to make much more effective use of the plan here described. It is not suggested or intended that any student shall undertake to apply the principles of this lesson, which is merely an introductory lesson, until he has mastered at least the next five lessons of the Law of Success course. The main purpose of this introductory lesson is to state some of the principles upon which the course is founded. These principles are more accurately described, and the student is taught in a very definite manner how to apply them in the individual lessons of the course. The automobile sales organization referred to in this summary meets a luncheon once a week. 1 hour and a half is devoted to luncheon and to the discussion of ways and means of applying the principles of this course. This gives each man an opportunity to profit by the ideas of all the other members of the organization. Two tables are set for the luncheon. At one table, all who have earned the right to membership in the one-a-week club are seated. At the other table, which is serviced with tinware instead of china, all who did not earn the right to membership in the club are seated. This, needless to say, becomes the object of considerable good-natured chiding from the more fortunate members seated at the other table. It is possible to make an almost endless variety of adaptations to this plan, both in the field of automobile salesmanship and in other fields of selling. The justification for its use is that it pays. It pays not only the leader or manager of the organization, but every member of the sales force as well. This plan has been briefly described for the purpose of showing the student of this course how to make practical application of the principles outlined in this course. The final acid test of any theory or rule or principle is that it will actually work. The law of the mastermind has been proved sound because it does work. If you understand this law, you are now ready to proceed with Lesson 2, in which you will be further and much more deeply initiated in the application of the principles described in this introductory lesson. Your six most dangerous enemies, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. Every person on earth is afraid of something. Most fears are inherited. In this essay, you may study the six basic fears which do the most damage. Your fears must be mastered before you can win in any worthwhile undertaking in life. Find out how many of the six fears are bothering you. But more important than this, determine also how to conquer these fears. In this picture, you have the opportunity to study our six worst enemies. These enemies are not beautiful. The artist who drew this picture and did not paint the six characters as ugly as they really are. If he had, no one would have believed him. As you read about these ugly characters, analyze yourself and find out which of them does you the most damage. The purpose of this essay is to help the readers of this course throw off these deadly enemies. Observe that the six characters are at your back where you cannot conveniently see them. Every human being on this earth is bound down to some extent by one or more of these unseen fears. The first step to be taken in killing off these enemies is to find out where and how you acquired them. They got their grip upon you through two forms of hereditary. One is known as physical hereditary, to which Darwin devoted so much study. The other is known as social hereditary, through which the fears, superstitions, and beliefs of men who lived during the Dark Ages have been passed on from one generation to another. Let us study first the part that physically hereditary has played in creating these six basic fears. Starting at the beginning, we find that nature has been a cruel builder, from the lowest form of life to the highest. Nature has permitted the stronger to prey upon the weaker forms of animal life. The fish prey upon the worms and insects, eating them bodily. Birds prey upon the fish. Higher forms of animal life prey upon the birds and upon one another, all the way up the line to man, and man preys upon all the lower forms of animal life, and upon man. The whole story of evolution is one unbroken chain of evidence of cruelty and destruction of the weaker by the stronger. No wonder the weaker forms of animal life have learned to fear the stronger. The fear consciousness is born in every living animal. So much for the fear instinct that came to us through physical hereditary. Now let us examine social hereditary and find out what part it has played in our makeup. The term social heredity has reference to everything that we are taught, everything we learn or gather from observation and experience with other living beings. Lay aside any prejudices and fixed opinions you may have formed, at least temporarily, and you may know the truth about your six worst enemies, starting with the fear of poverty. It requires courage to tell the truth about the history of this enemy of mankind, and still greater courage to hear the truth after it has been told. The fear of poverty grows out of man's habit of preying upon his fellow men, economically. The animals which have instinct but no power to think, prey upon one another physically. Man, with his superior sense of intuition and his more powerful weapon of thought, does not eat his fellow man bodily. He gets more pleasure from eating him financially. So great an offender is man in this respect that nearly every state and nation has been obliged to pass laws, scores of laws, to protect the weak from the strong. Every blue sky law is indisputable evidence of man's nature to prey upon his weaker brother economically. The second of the six basic fears with which man is bound down to is the fear of old age. This fear grows out of two major causes. First, the thought that old age may bring with it poverty. Secondly, from false and cruel sectarian teachings, which have been so well mixed with fear and brimstone that every human being learned to fear old age because it meant the approach of another and perhaps a more horrible world than this. The third of the six basic fears is the fear of ill health. This fear is born of both physical and social heredity. From birth until death, there is eternal warfare within every physical body. Warfare between groups of cells, one group being known as the friendly builders of the body, the other as the destroyers or disease germs. The seed of fear is born in the physical body, to begin with, as the result of nature's cruel plan of permitting the strong forms of cell life to prey upon the weaker. Social heredity has played its part through the lack of cleanliness and knowledge of sanitation. Also through the law of suggestion, cleverly manipulated by those who profited by ill health. The fourth of the six basic fears is the fear of loss of love of someone. This fear fills the asylums with the insanely jealous, for jealousy is nothing but a form of insanity. It also fills the divorce courts and causes murders and other forms of cruel punishment. It is a holdover, handed down through social heredity, from the Stone Age, when man preyed upon his fellow man by stealing his mate by physical force. The method, but not the practice, has now changed to some extent. Instead of physical force, man now steals his fellow man's mate with pretty colorful ribbons and fast motor cars and bootleg whiskey and sparkling rocks and stately mansions. Man is improving. He now entices where once he drove. The fifth of the six basic fears is the fear of criticism. Just how and where man got this fear is difficult to determine, but it is certain that he has it. But for this fear, men would not become bald-headed. Bald heads come from tightly fitting hat bands, which cut off the circulation from the roots of the hair. Women seldom are bald because they wear loose-fitting hats. But for fear of criticism, man would lay aside his hat and keep his hair. The makers of clothing have not been slow to capitalize this basic fear of mankind. Every season, the styles change, because the clothes makers know that few people have the courage to wear a garment that is one season out of step with that they call all wearing. If you doubt this, you gentlemen, start down the street with last year's narrow-brimmed straw hat on, when this year's style calls for the broad brim. Or you ladies, take a walk down the street on Easter morning with last year's hat on. Observe how many uncomfortable glares you are, thanks to your unseen enemy, the fear of criticism. The sixth and the last of the six basic fears is the most dreaded of all. It is called the fear of death. For tens of thousands of years, man has been asking the still unanswered question, whence and whither? The more crafty of the race have not been slow to offer the answer to this eternal question. Where did I come from, and where am I going after death? Come into my tent, says one leader, and you may go to heaven after death. Heaven was then pictured as a wonderful city whose streets were lined with gold and studded with precious stones. Remain out of my tent, and you may go straight to hell. Hell was then pictured as a blazing furnace where the poor victims might have the misery of burning forever in brimstone. No wonder mankind fears death. Take another look at the picture at the beginning of this essay and determine, if you can, which of the six basic fears is doing you the greatest damage. An enemy discovered is an enemy half-whipped. Thanks to the schools and colleges, man is slowly discovering these six enemies. The most effective tool with which to fight them is organized knowledge. Ignorance and fear are twin sisters. They are generally found together. But for ignorance and superstition, the six basic fears would disappear from man's nature in one generation. In every public library may be found the remedy for these six enemies of mankind, providing you know what books to read. Begin by reading The Science of Power by Benjamin Kidd, and you will have broken the stranglehold of most of your six basic fears. Follow this by reading Emerson's essay on compensation. Then select some good book on auto-suggestion or self-suggestion, and inform yourself on the principle through which your beliefs of today become the realities of tomorrow. Mind in the Making by Robinson will give you a good start towards understanding your own mind. Through the principle of social heredity, the ignorance and superstition of the Dark Ages have been passed on to you. But you are living in the modern age. On every hand, you may see evidence that every effect has a natural cause. Begin now to study effects by their causes, and soon you will emancipate your mind from the burden of the six basic fears. Begin by studying men who have accumulated great wealth, and find out the cause of their achievement. Henry Ford is a good subject to start with. Within the short period of 25 years, he has whipped poverty and made himself the most powerful man on earth. There was no luck or chance or accident back of his achievement. It grew out of his careful observation of certain principles, which are as available to you as they were to him. Henry Ford is not bound down by the six basic fears. Make no mistake about this. If you feel that you are too far away from Ford to study him accurately, then begin by selecting two people whom you know close at hand, one representing the idea of failure and the other corresponding to your idea of success. Find out what made one a failure and the other a success. Get the real facts. in the process of gathering these facts, you will have taught yourself a great lesson on cause and effect. Nothing ever just happens. Everything, from the lowest animal form that creeps on the earth or swims in the sea, on up to man, is the effect of nature's evolutionary process. Evolution is orderly change. No miracles are connected with this orderly change. Not only do the physical shapes and colors of animals undergo slow, orderly change from one generation to another, but the mind of man is also undergoing constant change. Herein lies your hope for improvement. You have the power to force your mind through a process of rather quick change. In a single month of properly directed self-suggestion, you may place your foot upon the neck of every one of your 6 basic fears. In 12 months of persistent effort, you may drive the entire herd into the corner where it will never again do you any serious injury. You will resemble, tomorrow, the dominating thoughts that you keep alive in your mind today. Plant in your mind the seed of determination to whip your 6 basic fears, and the battle will have been half won then and there. Keep this intention in your mind, and it will slowly push your 6 worst enemies out of sight, as they exist nowhere except in your own mind. The man who is powerful fears nothing, not even God. The powerful man loves God, but fears him never. Enduring power never grows out of fear. Any power that is built upon fear is bound to crumble and disintegrate. Understand this great truth, and you will never be so unfortunate as to try to raise yourself to power through the fears of other people who may owe you temporary allegiance. Verse: Man is of soul and body formed for deeds of high resolve on fancy's bold wing, to soar unwearied, fearlessly to turn, to keenest pains, to peacefulness and taste, the joys which mingled sense and spirit yield. Or he is formed from abjectness and woe, to grovel on the dunghill of his fears, to shrink at every sound, to quench the flame of natural love and sensualism to know. That hour is blessed when on his worthless days the frozen hand of death shall set its seal. Yet fear the cure, though hating the disease. The one is man that shall hereafter be. The other, man is vice, has made him now. Shelley. End of Lesson 1. Lesson 2. A definite chief aim. You can do it if you believe you can. You are at the beginning of a course of philosophy which for the first time in the history of the world has been organized from the known factors which have been used and must always be used by successful people. Literary style has been completely subordinated for the sake of stating the principles and laws included in this course in such a manner that they may be quickly and easily assimilated by people in every walk of life. Some of the principles described in the course are familiar to all who will read the course. Others are here stated for the first time. It should be kept in mind from the first lesson to the last that the value of the philosophy lies entirely in the thought stimuli it will produce in the mind of the student, and not merely in the lessons themselves. Stated in another way, this course is intended as a mind stimulant that will cause the student to organize and direct to a definite end the forces of his or her mind, thus harnessing the stupendous power which most people waste in spasmodic, purposeless thought. Singleness of purpose is essential for success. No matter what may be one's idea or the definition of success, yet singleness of purpose is a quality which may, and generally does, call for thought on many allied subjects. This author traveled a long distance to watch Jack Dempsey train for an oncoming battle. It was observed that he did not rely entirely upon one form of exercise, but resorted to many forms. The punching bag helped him develop one set of muscles and also trained his eye to be quick. The dumbbells trained still another set of muscles. Running developed the muscles of his legs and hips. A well-balanced food ration supplied the materials needed for building muscles without fat. Proper sleep, relaxation, and rest habits provided still other qualities which he must have in order to win. The student of this course is or should be engaged in the business of training for success in the battle of life. To win, there are many factors which must have attention. A well-organized, alert, and energetic mind is produced by various and sundry stimuli, all of which are plainly described in these lessons. It should be remembered, however, that the mind requires, for its development, a variety of exercise, just as the physical body, to be properly developed, calls for many forms of systematic energy. Horses are trained to certain gaits by trainers who hurdle jump them over handicaps which cause them to develop the desired steps, through habit and repetition. The human mind must be trained in a similar manner by a variety of thought-inspiring stimuli. You will observe, before you have gone very far into this philosophy, that the reading of these lessons will superinduce a flow of thoughts covering a wide range of subjects. For this reason, the student should read the course with a notebook and pencil at hand, and follow the practice of recording these thoughts or ideas as they come into the mind. By following this suggestion, the student will have a collection of ideas, by the time the course has been read 2 or 3 times, sufficient to transform his or her entire life plan. By following this practice, it will be noticed very soon that the mind has become like a magnet, in it that it will attract useful ideas right out of the thin air, to use the words of the noted scientist who has experimented with this principle for a great number of years. You will do yourself a great injustice if you undertake this course with even a remote feeling that you do not stand in need of more knowledge that you now possess. In truth, no man knows enough about any worthwhile subject to entitle him to feel that he has the last word on that subject. In the long, hard task of trying to wipe out some of my own ignorance and make way for some of the useful truths of life, I have often seen, in my imagination, the great marker who stands at the gateway entrance of life and writes, "Poor fool," on the brow of those who believe they are wise, and "Poor sinner," on the brow of those who believe they are saints, which translated into workaday language means that none of us know very much, and by the very nature of our being can never know as much as we need to know in order to live sanely and enjoy life while we live. Humility is a forerunner of success. Until we become humble in our own hearts, we are not apt to profit greatly by the experiences and thoughts of others. Does this sound like a preachment on morality? Well, what if it does? Even preachments, as dry and lacking in interest as they generally are, may be beneficial if they serve to reflect the shadow of our real selves, so we may get an approximate idea of our smallness and superficiality. Success in life is largely predicated upon our knowing men. The best place to study the man-animal is in your own mind, by taking as accurate an inventory as possible of yourself. When you know yourself thoroughly, if you ever do, you will also know much about others. To know others, not only as they seem to be, but as they really are, study them through the posture of the body and the way they walk, the tone of the voice, its quality, pitch, volume, the eyes, whether shifty or direct, the use of words, their trend, nature, and quality. Through these open windows, you may literally walk right into a man's soul and take a look at the real man. Going a step further, if you would know men, study them when angry, when in love, when money is involved, when eating, alone and unobserved, as they believe, when writing, when in trouble, when joyful and triumphant, when downcast and defeated, when facing catastrophe of a hazardous nature, when trying to make a good impression on others, when informed of another's misfortune, when informed of another's good fortune, when losing in any sort of game or sport, when winning at sport, when alone in a meditative mood. Before you can know any man as he really is, you must observe him in all the foregoing moods, and perhaps more, which is practically the equivalent of saying that you have no right to judge others at sight. Appearances count. There can be no doubt of that, but appearances are often deceiving. This course has been so designed that the student who masters it may take inventory of himself and of others by other than snap judgment. The student who masters this philosophy will be able to look through the outer crust of personal adornment, clothes, so-called culture and the like, and down deep into the heart of all about him. This is a very broad premise. It would not have been made if the author of this philosophy had not known from years of experimentation and analysis that the promise can be met. Some who have examined the manuscripts of this course have asked why it was not called a course in master salesmanship. The answer that the word salesmanship is commonly associated with the marketing of goods or services, and it would therefore narrow down and to circumscribe the real nature of the course. It is true that this is a course in master salesmanship, providing one takes a deeper than the average view of the meaning of salesmanship. This philosophy is intended to enable those who master it to sell their way through life successfully, with the minimum amount of resistance and friction. Such a course, therefore, must help the student organize and make use of much truth which is overlooked by the majority of people who go through life as mediocres. Not all people are so constituted that they wish to know the truth about all matters vitally affecting life. One of the great surprises the author of this course has met with in connection with his research activities is that so few people are willing to hear the truth when it shows up their own weaknesses. We prefer illusions to reality. New truths, if accepted at all, are taken with the proverbial grain of salt. Some of us demand more than a mere pinch of salt. We demand enough to pickle new ideas so they become useless. For these reasons, the introductory lesson of this course, and this lesson as well, covers subjects intended to pave the way for new ideas, so those ideas will not be too severe a shock to the mind of the student. The thought the author wishes to get across has been quite plainly stated by the editor of the American magazine in an editorial which appeared in a recent issue in the following words. On a rainy recent night, Carl Lohmann, the reindeer king of Alaska, told me a true story. It has stuck in my crop ever since, and now I am going to pass it along. A certain Greenland Eskimo, said Lohmann, was taken on one of the American North Polar expeditions a number of years ago. Later, as a reward for faithful service, he was brought to New York City for a short visit. At all the miracles of sight and sound he was filled with, a most amazed wonder. When he returned to his native village, he told stories of buildings that rose into the very face of the sky, of streetcars which he described as houses that moved along a trail, with people living in them as they moved. Mammoth bridges, artificial lights, and all the other dazzling components of the metropolis. His people looked at him coldly and walked away, and forthwith throughout the whole village he was dubbed Segluck, meaning the liar, and this name he carried in shame to his grave. Long before his death, his original name was entirely forgotten. When Knud Rasmussen made his trip from Greenland to Alaska, he was accompanied by a Greenland Eskimo named Mittik, Eider Duck. Mittik visited Copenhagen and New York, where he saw many things for the first time and was greatly impressed. Later, upon his return to Greenland, he recalled the tragedy of Segluck and decided that it would not be wise to tell the truth. Instead, he would narrate stories that his people could grasp and thus save his reputation. So he told them how he and Dr. Rasmussen maintained a kayak on the banks of a great river, the Hudson, and how each morning they paddled out for their hunting. Ducks, geese, and seals were to be had aplenty, and they enjoyed the visit immensely. Mittik, in the eyes of his countrymen, is a very honest man. His neighbors treat him with rare respect. The road of the truth-teller has always been rocky. Socrates sipping the hemlock, Christ crucified, Stephen stoned, Bruno burned at the stake, Galileo terrified into retraction of his starry truths. Forever could one follow that bloody trail through the pages of history. Something in human nature makes us resent the impact of new ideas. We hate to be disturbed in the beliefs and prejudices that have been handed down with the family furniture. At maturity, too many of us go into hibernation and live off the fat of ancient fetishes. If a new idea invades our den, we rise up snarling from our winter sleep. The Eskimos, at least, had some excuse. They were unable to visualize the startling pictures drew by Seglat. Their simple lives had been too long circumscribed by the brooding Arctic night. But there is no adequate reason why the average man should ever close his mind to fresh slants on life. He does just the same. Nothing is more tragic or more common than mental inertia. For every 10 men who are physically lazy, there are 10,000 with stagnant minds. And stagnant minds are the breeding places of fear. An old farmer up in Vermont always used to wind up his prayers with this plea, "O God, give me an open mind." If more people followed his example, they might escape being hamstrung by prejudice. And what a pleasant place to live in the world would be. Every person should make it his business to gather new ideas from sources other than the environment in which he daily lives and works. The mind becomes withered, stagnant, narrow and closed unless it searches for new ideas. The farmer should come to the city quite often and walk among the strange faces in the tall buildings. He will go back to his farm, his mind refreshed with more courage and greater enthusiasm. The city man should take a trip to the country every so often and freshen his mind with sights new and different from those associated with his daily labors. Everyone needs a change of mental environment at regular periods. The same as a change in variety of food are essential. The mind becomes more alert, more elastic, and more ready to work with speed and accuracy after it has been bathed in new ideas, outside of one's own field of daily labor. As a student of this course, you will temporarily lay aside the set of ideas with which you perform your daily labors and enter a field of entirely new and, in some instances, heretofore unheard of ideas. Splendid! You will come out at the other end of this course with a new stock of ideas which will make you more efficient, more enthusiastic, and more courageous, no matter in what sort of work you may be engaged. Do not be afraid of new ideas. They may mean to you the difference between success and failure. Some of the ideas introduced in this course will require no further explanation or proof of their soundness because they are familiar to practically everyone. Other ideas here introduced are new, and for that very reason, many students of this philosophy may hesitate to accept them as sound. Every principle described in this course has been thoroughly tested by the author, and the majority of the principles covered have been tested by scores of scientists and others who were quite capable of distinguishing between the merely theoretic and the practical. For these reasons, all principles here covered are known to be workable in the exact manner claimed for them. However, no student of this course is asked to accept any statement made in these lessons without having first satisfied himself or herself by tests, experiments, and analysis that the statement is sound. The major evil the student is requested to avoid is that of forming opinions without definite facts as the basis, which brings to mind Herbert Spencer's famous admonition in these words, "There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. This principle is contempt prior to examination." It may be well to bear this principle in mind when you come to study the law of the mastermind described in his lessons. This law embodies an entirely new principle of mind operation, and for this reason alone, it will be difficult for many students to accept it as sound until after they have experimented with it. When this fact is considered, however, that the law of the mastermind is believed to be the real basis of most of the achievements of those who are considered geniuses, this law takes on an aspect which calls for more than a snap judgment opinion. It is believed by many scientific men whose opinions on the subject have been given the author of this philosophy that the law of the mastermind is the basis of practically all of the more important achievements resulting from group or cooperative effort. The late Dr. Alexander Graham Bell said he believed the law of the mastermind as it had been described in his philosophy, was not only sound, but that all the higher institutions of learning would soon be teaching that law as part of their courses in psychology. Charles P. Steinmetz said that he had experimented with the law and had arrived at the same conclusion as that stated in these lessons, long before he talked to the author of the Law of Success philosophy about the subject. Luther Burbank and John Burroughs made similar statements. Edison was never interrogated on the subject, but other statements of his indicate that he would endorse the law as being a possibility, if not in fact a reality. Dr. Elmer Gates endorsed the law in a conversation with this author more than 15 years ago. Dr. Gates is a scientist of the highest order, ranking along with Steinmetz, Edison, and Bell. The author of this philosophy has talked to scores of intelligent businessmen who, while they were not scientists, admitted they believed in the soundness of the law of the mastermind. It is hardly excusable, therefore, for men of less ability to judge such matters, to form opinions as to this law without serious, systematic investigation. Let me lay before you a brief outline of what this lesson is and what it is intended to do for you. Having prepared myself for the practice of law, I will offer this introduction as a statement of my case. The evidence with which to back up my case will be presented in the 16 lessons of which the course is composed. The facts out of which this course has been prepared have been gathered through more than 25 years of business and professional experience, and my only explanation of the rather free use of the personal pronoun throughout the course is that I am writing from first-hand experience. Before this reading course on the Law of Success was published, the manuscripts were submitted to two prominent universities with the request that they be read by competent professors with the object of eliminating or correcting any statements that appeared to be unsound from an economic viewpoint. This request was compiled with, the manuscripts were carefully examined, with the result that not a single change was made with the exception of one or two slight changes in wording. One of the professors who examined the manuscripts expressed himself in part as follows: "It is a tragedy that every boy and girl who enters high school is not efficiently drilled on the 15 major parts of your reading course on the Law of Success. It is regrettable that the great universities with which I am connected and every other university does not include your course as part of its curriculum. Inasmuch as this reading course is intended as a map or blueprint that will guide you in the attainment of that coveted goal called success, may it not be well here to define success. Success is a development of the power with which to get whatever one wants in life without interfering with the rights of others. I would lay particular stress upon the word power, because it is inseparably related to success. We are living in a world and during an age of intense competition, and the law of the survival of the fittest is everywhere in evidence. Because of these facts, all who would enjoy enduring success must go about its attainment through the use of power. And what is power? Power is organized energy or effort. This course is properly called the Law of Success for the reason that it teaches how one may organize facts and knowledge and the faculties of one's mind into a unit of power. This course brings you a definite promise, namely, that through its mastery and application you can get whatever you want, with but two qualifying words, within reason. This qualification takes into consideration your education, your wisdom or your lack of it, your physical endurance, your temperament, and all of the other qualities mentioned in the 16 lessons of this course as being the factors most essential in the attainment of success. Without a single exception, those who have attained unusual success have done so, either consciously or unconsciously, through the aid of all or a portion of the 15 major factors in which this course is compiled. If you doubt this statement, then master these 16 lessons so you can go about the analysis with reasonable accuracy and analyze such men as Carnegie, Rockefeller, Hill, Harriman, Ford, and others of this type who have accumulated great fortunes of material wealth, and you will see that they understood and applied the principles of organized effort, which runs like a golden cord of indisputable evidence throughout this course. Nearly 20 years ago, I interviewed Mr. Carnegie for the purpose of writing a story about him. During the interview, I asked him to what he attributed his success. With a merry little twinkle in his eyes, he said, "Young man, before I answer your question, will you please define your term success?" After waiting until he saw that I was somewhat embarrassed by his request, he continued, "By success, you have reference to my money, have you not?" I assured him that money was the term by which most people measured success, and he then said, "Oh, well, if you wish to know how I got my money, if that is what you call success, I will answer your question by saying that we have a mastermind here in our business, and that mind is made up of more than a score of men who constitute my personal staff of superintendents and managers and accountants and chemists and other necessary types. No one person in this group is the mastermind of which I speak, but the sum total of the minds in this group, coordinated, organized, and directed to a definite end in the spirit of harmonious cooperation, is the power that got my money for me. No two minds in the group are exactly alike, but each man in the group does the thing that he is supposed to do, and he does it better than any other person in the world could do it. Then and there, the seed out of which this course has been developed was sown in my mind. But that seed did not take root or germinate until later. This interview marked the beginning of years of research which led finally to the discovery of the principle of psychology described in the introductory lesson as the mastermind. I heard all that Mr. Carnegie said, but it took the knowledge gained from many years of subsequent contact with the business world to enable me to assimilate that which he said and clearly grasp and understand the principle behind it, which was nothing more than less than the principle of organized effort upon which this course on the law of success is founded. Carnegie's group of men constituted a mastermind, and that mind was so well organized, so well coordinated, so powerful, that it could have accumulated millions of dollars for Mr. Carnegie in practically any sort of endeavor of a commercial or industrial nature. The steel business in which that mind was engaged was but an incident in connection with the accumulation of the Carnegie wealth. That same wealth could have been accumulated had the mastermind been directed into the coal business, or the banking business, or the grocery business, for the reason that back of the mind was power, that sort of power which you may have when you shall have organized the faculties of your own mind and allied yourself with others' well-organized minds for the attainment of a definite chief aim in life. A careful checkup with several of Mr. Carnegie's former business associates, which is made after this course was begun, proves conclusively not only that there is such a law as that which has been called the mastermind, but that this law was the chief source of Mr. Carnegie's success. Perhaps no man was ever associated with Mr. Carnegie who knew better than did Mr. C. M. Schwab. In the following words, Mr. Schwab was very accurately described that subtle something in Mr. Carnegie's personality which enabled him to rise to such stupendous heights. "I never knew a man with so much imagination, lively intelligence, and instinctive comprehension. You sensed that he probed your thoughts and took stock of everything that you had ever done or might do. He seemed to catch at your next word before it was spoken. The play of his mind was dazzling, and his habit of close observation gave him a store of knowledge about innumerable matters. But his outstanding quality from so rich an endowment was the power of inspiring other men. Confidence radiated from him. You might be doubtful about something and discuss the matter with Mr. Carnegie. In a flash, he would make you see that it was right and then absolutely believe it. Or he might settle your doubts by pointing out its weakness. This quality of attracting others, then spurring them on, arose from his own strength. The results of his leadership were remarkable. Never before in history of industry, I imagine, was there a man who, without understanding his business in its working details, making no pretense of technical knowledge concerning steel or engineering, was yet able to build up such an enterprise. Mr. Carnegie's ability to inspire men rested on something deeper than any faculty of judgment. In the last sentence, Mr. Schwab has conveyed a thought which corroborates the theory of the mastermind, to which the author of this course has attributed the chief source of Mr. Carnegie's power. Mr. Schwab has also confirmed the statement that Mr. Carnegie could have succeeded as well in any other business as he did in the steel business. It is obvious that his success was due to his understanding of his own mind and the minds of other men, and not to mere knowledge of the steel business itself. This thought is most consoling to those who have not yet attained outstanding success, for it shows that success is solely a matter of correctly applying laws and principles which are available to all. And these laws, let us not forget, are fully described in the 16 lessons of this course. Mr. Carnegie learned how to apply the law of mastermind. This enabled him to organize the faculties of his own mind and the faculties of other men's minds, and coordinate the whole behind a definite chief aim. Every strategist, whether in business or war or industry or other callings, understands the value of organized, coordinated effort. Every military strategist understands the value of sowing seeds of dissension in the ranks of the opposing forces, because this breaks up the power of coordination back of the opposition. During the late World War, much was heard about the effects of propaganda, and it seems not an exaggeration to say that the disorganizing forces of propaganda were much more destructive than were all the guns and explosives used in the war. One of the most important turning points of the World War came when the Allied enemies were placed under the direction of the French general Foch. There are well-informed military men who claim that this was the move which spelled doom for the opposing armies. Any modern railroad bridge is an excellent example of the value of organized effort, because it demonstrates quite simply and clearly how thousands of tons of weight may be borne by a comparatively small group of steel bars and beams so arranged that the weight is spread over the entire group. There was a man who had 7 sons who were always quarreling among themselves. One day he called them together and informed them that he wished to demonstrate just what their lack of cooperative effort meant. He had prepared a bundle of 7 sticks, which he had carefully tied together. One by one he asked his sons to take the bundle and break it. Each son tried, but in vain. Then he cut the string and asked one of the sticks to each of his sons and asked him to break it over his knee. After the sticks had all been broken with ease, he said, "When you boys work together in a spirit of harmony, you resemble the bundle of sticks, and no one can defeat you. But when you quarrel among yourselves, anyone can defeat you one at a time." There is a worthwhile lesson in this story of the man and his 7 quarrelsome sons. And it may be applied to the power of a community, the employees and employers in a given place of employment, or to the state and nation in which we live. Organized effort may be made a power, but it may also be a dangerous power unless guided with intelligence, which is the chief reason why the 16th lesson of this course is devoted largely to describing how to direct the power of organized effort so that it will lead to success. That sort of success which is founded upon truth and justice and fairness that lead to ultimate happiness. One of the outstanding tragedies of this age of struggle and money madness is the fact that so few people are engaged in the effort which they like best. One of the objects of this course is to help each student find his or her particular niche in the world's work, where both material prosperity and happiness in abundance may be found. For this purpose, a character analysis chart accompanies the 16th lesson. This chart is designed to help the student take inventory of himself and find out what latent ability and hidden force lies sleeping within him. This entire course is intended as a stimulus with which to enable you to see yourself and your hidden forces as they are, and to awaken in you the ambition and the vision and determination to cause you to go forth and claim that which is rightfully yours. Less than 30 years ago, a man was working in the same shop with Henry Ford, doing practically the same sort of work that he was doing. It has been said that this man was really a more competent workman in that particular sort of work than Ford. Today, this man is still engaged in the same sort of work, at wages of less than $100 a week, while Mr. Ford is the world's richest man. What outstanding difference is there between these two men which has so widely separated them in terms of material wealth? Just this. Ford understood and applied the principle of organized effort, while the other man did not. In the little city of Shelby, Ohio, as these lines are being written, for the first time in the history of the world, this principle of organized effort is being applied for the purpose of bringing about a closer alliance between the churches and the business houses of a community. The clergymen and businessmen have formed an alliance, with the result that practically every church in the city is squarely back of every businessman, and every businessman is squarely back of every church. This effect has been the strengthening of the churches and the business houses to such an extent that it has been said that it would be practically impossible for any individual member of either class to fail in his calling. The others who belong to the alliance will permit no such failure. Here is an example of what may happen when groups of men form an alliance for the purpose of placing the combined power of the group back of each individual unit. The alliance has brought both material and moral advantages to the city of Shelby, such as are enjoyed by few other cities of its size in America. The plan has worked so effectively and so satisfactorily that a movement is now underway to extend it to other cities throughout America. That you may gain a still more concrete vision of just how this principle of organized effort can be made powerful, stop for a moment and allow your imagination to draw a picture of what would likely be the result if every church and every newspaper and every Rotary Club and every Kiwanis Club and every advertising club and woman's club and every other civic organization of a similar nature in your city or in any other city in the United States should form an alliance for the purpose of pooling their power and using it for the benefit of all members of these organizations. The results which might easily be attained by such an alliance stagger the imagination. There are three outstanding powers in the world of organized effort. They are the churches, the schools, and the newspapers. Think might easily happen if these three great powers and molders of public opinion should ally themselves together for the purpose of bringing about any needed change in human conduct. They could, in a single generation, so modify the present standard of business ethics, for example, that it would practically be business suicide for anyone to try to transact business under any standard except that of the Golden Rule. Such an alliance could be made to produce sufficient influence to change, in a single generation, the business, social, and moral tendencies of the entire civilized world. Such an alliance would have sufficient power to force upon the minds of the oncoming generations any ideals desired. Power is organized effort, as has already been stated. Success is based upon power. That you may have a clear conception of what is meant by the term organized effort, I have made use of the foregoing illustration. And for the sake of further emphasis, I am going to repeat the statement that the accumulation of great wealth and the attainment of any high station in life, such as constitute what we ordinarily call success, are based upon the vision to comprehend and the ability to assimilate and apply the major principles of the 16 lessons of this course. This course is in complete harmony with the principles of economics and the principles of applied psychology. You will observe that those lessons, which depend for their practical application upon knowledge of psychology, have been supplemented with sufficient explanation of the psychological principles involved to render the lessons easily understood. Before the manuscripts for this course went to the publisher, they were submitted to some of the foremost bankers and businessmen of America, that they might be examined, analyzed, and criticized by the most practical type of mind. One of the best-known bankers in New York City returned the manuscript with the following comment: "I hold a master's degree from Yale, but I would willingly exchange all that and this degree has brought me in return for what your course on the law of success would have brought me had I been afforded the privilege of making it part of my training while I was studying at Yale. My wife and daughter have all also read the manuscript, and my wife has named your course the Master Keyboard of Life, because she believes that all who understand how to apply it may